Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
Back in 1811, fur trader Henry Brackenridge recorded the following in his journal. Quote, "We have on board a Frenchman named Charbonneau, with his wife, an Indian woman of the Snake Nation, both of whom accompanied Lewis and Clark to the Pacific and were of great service. The woman, a good creature of a mild and gentle disposition, was greatly attached to the whites, whose manners and airs she tries to imitate, but has become sickly and longs to revisit her native country." End quote. This woman of the Snake Nation, aka the Shoshone, was almost certainly the now famous Sacagawea. Sadly, over a year later, on December 20th, 1812, Brackenridge noted, quote, "The wife of Charbonneau, a snake squaw, died of the putrid fever. She was a good and best woman in the fort, aged about 25 years, and she left behind a fine infant girl." End quote. Now, that infant girl was most likely Sacagawea's daughter, Lizette. She and her older brother, Jean-Baptiste, were eventually given into the care of William Clark over in St. Louis, but unfortunately, historians do believe that Lizette died while still very young. And speaking of William Clark, sometime in the mid-1820s, he too would state that Sacagawea was dead. Okay, sounds pretty cut and dry, right? Well, maybe not. Turns out there are rumors suggesting otherwise. Legend has it that rather than dying, Sacagawea simply just ran off on her husband Charbonneau and ended up marrying into the Comanche tribe, lived with them for quite some time before returning to her own people, the Shoshone. She possibly resided at Fort Bridger for a spell, but would ultimately settle down at the Wind River Indian Reservation in Wyoming. And it's there where she supposedly passed away in the summer of 1884. Hell, there's even a grave marker on the reservation dedicated to her. But how true is that? Is Sacagawea really buried at Wind River? Turns out that in 1925, Dr. Charles Eastman, himself a Native American physician, was tasked with locating Sacagawea's final resting place. He interviewed several old-timers there at Wind River and determined that an old Comanche lady, going by the name of Porivo, was in all actuality Sacagawea. Apparently, some of those who he spoke with stated that Porivo had described a long journey she went on with white men, and that she even had in her possession a silver peace medal featuring the likeness of Thomas Jefferson, the same type of medal that Lewis and Clark often handed out to the indigenous. At the end of the day, though, I guess it just depends on who you're willing to believe. Dr. Eastman and the Shoshone, or William Clark and that fur trader, Henry Brackenridge. As for the fate of Sacagawea's son, Jean-Baptiste, and her not-so-nice husband, Toussaint Charbonneau, we will be discussing them here in just a bit. We'll also take a look at what became of a few other members of the Lewis and Clark expedition. And yeah, we will look into the mysterious death of Meriwether Lewis. Warning, it ain't pretty, and the story you're about to hear is not for the faint of heart. My name's Josh, and this is the Wild West Extravaganza. Captain Meriwether Lewis was taking careful aim when the ball struck him, entering his left eye about an inch below the hip joint and exiting out his right ass cheek. Now, me personally, I've never been shot, at least not with anything stronger than a BB gun. But I have been told that it feels like getting hit with a searing hot baseball bat, or as Lewis described the pain, very severe. Turns out he and Private Cruzette had been out hunting when they wounded an elk. Looking to finish the job, the pair split up and began stalking the injured animal through the brush. Lewis spotted the elk first and had just shouldered his rifle when, much to his surprise, it was he who got shot. Now, Cruzette was horribly nearsighted, and Captain Lewis initially figured that the damn fool had mistaken him for the wounded elk. Calling out in what I imagine was some not-so-nice language, Lewis yelled for Cruzette, but there was no answer. He hollered again, and the result was the same. Silence. This was repeated a couple more times, and Lewis started getting nervous, thinking now that perhaps he was wrong and that his assailant was a native warrior, possibly looking for another shot. Lewis called out once more, this time instructing Cruzette to make a run for it as he did the same. Within minutes, Captain Lewis was back at the river and rallying the others to the private's rescue. Remember, at this point, he had pretty much convinced himself that they were under attack. Lewis attempted to join the relief party, but his leg finally gave out from underneath him, so instead, he just crawled over into one of the canoes and prepared to, quote, sell my life as dearly as possible, end quote. Thankfully, the men soon returned with an unharmed, yet seemingly confused, Private Crusette in tow. Not only did he swear up and down that it wasn't him who shot Lewis, but he also claimed not to have even heard the captain hollering. For what it's worth, Lewis did have the discharged ball. Apparently, it had lodged in his buckskin leggings, and it was of the exact same caliber as Crusette's rifle. Surprise, surprise. While Lewis would later write that he didn't believe Crusette shot him intentionally, he also never bought into the private's denials. As far as the wound goes, luckily no bones were hit, but still, it was extremely painful, and Captain Lewis was effectively out of commission, relegated to laying on his belly in one of the canoes, ass up, the entire way downriver till they met up with Captain Clark. Now, if you'll recall, the captains split up back at Traveler's Rest in early July, and unlike Lewis, Clark's journey had been relatively uneventful. The always valuable and way underrated Sacagawea had guided he and his men through the Bozeman Pass and down onto the Yellowstone. The only real problem they ran into was having about 24 of their horses stolen. Nevertheless, they constructed a pair of large dugouts and were successful in navigating the Yellowstone to where it meets the Missouri in present-day North Dakota. And it's there, on August 12th, that the captains were finally reunited. As for Sergeant Pryor and the three others who were tasked with taking the remaining horses to the Mandan, well, that didn't exactly go as planned. As luck would have it, they were only a day into their journey when they, too, had their horses stolen. All of them. Rather than continue on foot, they threw together a couple of bull boats, and by August 8th, they hooked back up with Clark. A few days later, here comes Lewis and his ventilated backside, and for the first time in nearly a month and a half, the Corps of Discovery was whole again, save for a sizable chunk of flesh missing from Meriwether Lewis's ass cheek. The expedition would arrive back at the Mandan villages on August 14th, at which point Charbonneau was discharged from duty and given a $500 payment for his services. As for his wife, Sacagawea, she'd receive exactly $0. Sign of the times, I guess, but sadly, much like with Clark's slave York, Sacagawea, for all intents and purposes, was simply a piece of property, and thus not compensated. By the way, I had somebody correct me on that recently. I guess they thought I was saying intensive purposes or something along those lines. I am saying intents and purposes. If it sounds like I'm running the words together, that's my bad. Y'all know I can't talk, right? Now, I was also there among the Mandan where the Corps of Discovery would say their goodbyes to Private John Coulter. Right around the same time that the expedition had reached the villages, they were met by a pair of Americans named Forrest Hancock and Joseph Dixon. This enterprising duo had plans on trapping beaver along the Yellowstone and were hoping that Coulter would join them. He agreed, and even though his enlistment wouldn't officially end for another 2 months, Captain Lewis granted permission. Dude had been away from civilization for over 2 years. And just as his companions were on their way back to soft beds and strong whiskey, Coulter instead turned his face once more towards the west, and in doing so, would come to be known as the first of a new breed called the Mountain Men. But that's another story for another day. Actually, it's going to be our story next week. Believe it or not, I started this whole series with the idea of covering John Coulter, and it just kind of morphed into what you're hearing now. But don't worry, like I said, next week we will continue with the life and death of John Coulter. The remaining members of the expedition, along with a Mandan chief named Big White, would depart on August 20th, and the return trip home was mostly without incident. They anticipated trouble from the Lakota, and at one point even thought they were being shot at, but it just turned out to be some friendly Yankton engaging in target practice. Now, it's worth pointing out that the peace that Lewis and Clark had initially attempted to establish there along the Missouri did end up as an abject failure. In their absence out west, the Ricara had resumed fighting the Mandan, along with the Lakota and the Hidatsa, making raids against the Omaha and the Shoshone and damn near everybody else. Nevertheless, the Corps of Discovery would arrive at St. Louis to a hero's welcome on September 23, 1806. After 2 years, 4 months, and 10 days, they were finally home, minus Sergeant Floyd and John Coulter. Speaking of Floyd, I failed to mention this a moment ago, but they did stop at his grave on their way home and pay their respects. Now, for the most part, despite the lack of peace on the Upper Missouri, and despite there not being an all-water route to the Pacific, or the territory of Louisiana not extending to the 50th parallel, the Corps of Discovery was considered a success. After all, Lewis and Clark had met their objective of reaching the West Coast, solidifying American claims not only to Louisiana, but also the Pacific Northwest. And although their peace policy was largely in shambles, the captains had established trade and diplomatic relations with at least a few tribes. They were also able to gain valuable information on the natural habitat, the flora and fauna, in addition to bringing back numerous plant and mineral specimens. I think all total they ended up accurately describing over 200 new animal and plant species during the course of the expedition, not to mention all the ethnographic studies they conducted among the natives. Then, of course, there was all the mapping and topography. Many a blank spot on the map was filled in thanks to Lewis and Clark. So yeah, all in all, the expedition proved to be a huge win for the United States. And I don't know about you, but I'm still amazed they only lost one man during the entire journey. Now, upon arriving in St. Louis, the men of the expedition were awarded land grants, 320 acres apiece, along with double wages. If I'm not mistaken, this meant that the sergeants ended up earning $16 per month, and the privates a whopping $10. Many of them would end up selling their land grants, and in the months and years to come, some would even head back out west. Now, I'm not planning on discussing the fate of each and every member of the Corps of Discovery, but I will go over a few of the more notable characters. Men like George Drewer, quite possibly one of the most capable men of the expedition. Not one to stay put, Drewer headed upriver again in 1807 with fur trader Manuel Lisa, helped to establish a trading post on the Yellowstone River, and believe it or not, would even find himself on trial for murder. Apparently, Drewer, on the orders of his boss, Manuel Lisa, had shot a deserter. The would-be defector later died of his wounds, and the next time George was in St. Louis, he was slapped with a big old fat murder indictment. Luckily for him, one of the jury members was former Corps of Discovery alumni George Shannon, and ultimately Drewer was fully acquitted. Sadly, this luck would not hold out. After more than a few close calls with the Blackfeet in the spring of 1810, many of Drewer's fur-trapping buddies skedaddled on back to St. Louis. Not Drewer, though. Said he was too much of an engine to be caught by the engines, and as such, he continued trapping there at Three Forks. At least he did till the Blackfeet punched his number in late May. Now, a moment ago, I mentioned George Shannon, the youngest member of the Corps. In the fall of 1807, Shannon was with Sergeant Pryor and a few others, attempted to bring Big White back to the Mandan. They ran into trouble with the Ricara, and Shannon ended up taking a ball to the leg. By the time he got himself some proper doctoring, the damn leg was turning sour, so the sawbones had to amputate. Despite spending the rest of his life walking on a peg leg, Shannon would go on to get his law degree and become a well-respected attorney. Things took a turn for the worse in 1833, however, when his wife died from typhus. Shannon hit the bottle and never found his way out, dying less than 3 years later at the age of 51. Next up, we got Sacagawea's family. Remember, they had remained behind at the Mandan villages when everyone else headed back to St. Louis. At the time, Captain Clark had put forth the idea of taking little Pomp back with him and seeing to it that he got a proper education, but Sacagawea declined the offer. That said, she and her husband would move to St. Louis the following year, and in 1809, when they headed back up the Missouri, this time they did leave little Pomp in the care of William Clark. I keep calling him Pomp, but his actual name was Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau. The youngster would end up getting an expensive education at a Jesuit Catholic school, and oddly enough, in 1823, at the age of 18, Pomp set sail for Europe and ended up living among royalty in Germany for a number of years. Now, not a whole lot is known about this time that Pomp spent in Germany, but by 1829, he was back in the U.S. and employed as a fur trapper, working alongside the likes of Jim Bridger and James Beckwith. In the years that followed, Pomp would work as a guide, hunter, and even a magistrate of sorts down in Southern California, before finally taking part in the Great California Gold Rush of the 1840s. At some point in early 1866, Pomp decided to try his luck at the new gold diggings over in Montana, but he wouldn't make it. Ended up falling into the Owyhee River in present-day northern Nevada, catching pneumonia and passing away. He was 61 years old at the time of his death. Speaking of the Owyhee, I did mention that river and the Owyhee Desert extensively in a recent episode I did on Claude Dallas. Link down in the show notes if you missed that one. Fun fact, the Owyhee River and the Owyhee Desert were named after Hawaiians. Yes, there were Hawaiians in the Old West, and many of them worked as fur trappers and scouts. But you would already know that if you signed up for the 100% free Wild West Extravaganza newsletter. I just recently put out an edition all about the Hawaiian fur trappers and cowboys. So if you'd like to check that out, head on over to wildwestextra.com and hit that newsletter tab up top. Or you can go there directly at wildwestjosh.substack.com. Now, we've already discussed Pomp's mother, Sacagawea, but what about his father, Toussaint Charbonneau? Old Toussaint would remain out west and work as a translator for several years, both as a government employee and for various fur companies. He would remarry. I think all total, Charbonneau had something like 5 Native American wives, and not a damn one of them were over the age of 16 when they got married. Apparently, his last bride was a 14-year-old Assiniboine girl when he was already over the age of 70. Yikes. Not a very well-liked guy, Toussaint Charbonneau. And rumor has it, he was not very nice to the ladies. The exact timing or cause of his death is unknown, but in 1843, his son, Jean-Baptiste, would settle his estate. Like I said, I'm not going to go over each and every member of the Corps of Discovery, but I will cover a couple more next week when we discuss John Coulter. And if you're still curious for more of a deep dive, I'd strongly urge you to check out Episode 8 of the Explorers podcast series on Lewis and Clark, linked down in the show notes. Also, an excellent source of all things Lewis and Clark is the website lewis-clark.org. If you go digging around on there, you should be able to find a great summary of damn near everybody involved in the expedition. I found that site to be invaluable when researching this series. For today, though, I think we'll go ahead and wrap things up by discussing the fate of the captains. William Clark would be appointed as Brigadier General of the Louisiana Militia, as well as U.S. Agent for Indian Affairs. Following his service in the War of 1812, Clark would then be appointed as governor of the newly formed Missouri Territory. And even after that, the promotions just kept on a-coming. The year 1822 would see yet another presidential appointment, with Clark being named as Superintendent of Indian Affairs. And then, just a couple of years later, he'd be appointed as Surveyor General of Illinois, Missouri, and the Territory of Arkansas. Clark would end up marrying twice and having at least 8 children before passing away in September of 1838 at the age of 68. And of course, we've already discussed the fate of Clark's slave York and York's mistreatment at the hands of Clark earlier in this series. Finally, last but certainly not least, we come to Captain Meriwether Lewis. After returning to civilized society, Lewis was appointed as the governor of Louisiana Territory, and after a brief trip back east, he settled down in St. Louis to prepare his journal for publication. And suffice to say, things did not go as planned. Lewis tried and failed on more than one occasion to secure a wife. He was very slow on finalizing his journal, and he quarreled extensively with Louisiana Secretary Frederick Bates. To further exasperate matters, Lewis began to drink to excess, as well as ingesting medicine laced with opium and morphine. Whether this was due to the pain from that hip wound or to treat a lingering case of malaria is unknown. Lewis began to borrow heavily, his finances crumbled, and his behavior became increasingly more and more erratic. It was while in such a state that he left St. Louis on September 3, 1809, bound for Washington, D.C. The initial plan was to take the river down to New Orleans and then catch a boat to the capital, but somewhere along the way, Lewis changed his mind and instead chose to travel up the Natchez Trace. On September 11, 1809, Lewis, then just 35 years of age, wrote out his last will and testament, leaving everything to his mother, Lucy. He also penned a final letter to his old friend, William Clark. Now, this letter has since been lost to history, but there are some who think that it may have been a suicide note of sorts. Matter of fact, between leaving St. Louis and arriving at Fort Pickering, Tennessee, Lewis had attempted to take his own life twice and had to be restrained by the boat crew. We do not know in what manner Lewis attempted suicide, only that one of the attempts, quote, nearly succeeded, end quote. Once at Fort Pickering, where the city of Memphis now stands, Lewis drank heavily while at the same time downing pills. This behavior, coupled with the recent incidents on the boat after departing St. Louis, caused the officer in charge, Captain Gilbert Russell, to place Lewis on a 24-hour suicide watch. Finally, after 6 or 7 days, Lewis did seem to improve. According to Captain Russell, quote, "All symptoms of derangement disappeared and he was completely in his senses," end quote. Evidently, Lewis was deeply ashamed of his actions and swore to Russell that he would never drink again. On September 29th, Lewis departed Fort Pickering via horseback and in the company of his personal servant, a freedman by the name of John Pernier, a Major James Neely, who was the U.S. agent to the Chickasaw Nation, and Neely's servant, whose name I do not know. They headed overland along the Natchez Trace and covered 100 miles in 3 days. But at some point, Lewis began to once again hit the bottle, despite his most recent resolution not to. Now, for some reason, they did make a slight detour south to the Chickasaw Agency, not far from present-day Houston, Mississippi, where Major Neely recalled that Lewis, quote, "appeared at times deranged in mind," end quote. Worth noting that the words deranged or derangement would be used by many people to describe Lewis's frame of mind during this period. The guy was just not doing well mentally. They rested at the agency for a couple of days and proceeded onward, crossing the Tennessee River on October 9th. That evening, a couple of horses strayed, and as Neely went out to search for them, Lewis continued on alone, stopping at a place called Grinder's Inn, about 75 or 80 miles southwest of Nashville. Mr. Grinder was away at the time, but his wife Priscilla was running the place. She asked Lewis if he was traveling alone, and he said no, that there were two servants coming up the trail behind him. Sure enough, as he settled down to drink some quote-unquote spirits, here comes Pernier along with Neely's servant. Oddly enough, Lewis asked Pernier where the gunpowder was, but Pernier wisely evaded the question. As the evening progressed, Mrs. Grinder continued to note Lewis's erratic behavior, said that he would pace back and forth, act as if he was walking up to her, and then just wheel around all of a sudden and walk away as fast as possible. Then later on, as they sat down to eat dinner, Lewis began speaking to himself in what she described as a violent manner. Eventually, Lewis arose and stepped outside to light a pipe, remarking on how pleasant of an evening it was. I think, once more, the words of Stephen Ambrose are worth quoting. The following are the last few paragraphs in Chapter 39 of Mr. Ambrose's book, Undaunted Courage. Just a fair warning, though. What you're about to hear is very graphic. Quote, "Mrs. Grinder began to prepare a bed for him, but he stopped her and said that he would sleep on the floor, explaining that since his journey to the Pacific, he could no longer sleep on a feather bed. He had Pernier bring in his bearskins and buffalo robe and spread them on the floor. While Pernier was getting the bedding, Lewis found some gunpowder. Mrs. Grinder went to the kitchen to sleep, and the servants went to the barn, some 200 yards distant. Lewis began pacing in his room. This went on for several hours. Mrs. Grinder, who was frightened and could not sleep, heard him talking aloud like a lawyer. Lewis got out his pistols. He loaded them and, at some point during the early hours of October 11th, shot himself in the head. The ball only grazed his skull. He fell heavily to the floor. Mrs. Grinder heard him exclaim, 'Oh, Lord!' Lewis rose, took up his other pistol, and shot himself in the breast. The ball entered and passed downward through his body, to emerge low down on his backbone. He survived the second shot, staggered to the door of his room, and called out, 'Oh, madam, give me some water and heal my wounds.' Lewis staggered outside, fell, crawled for some distance, raised himself by the side of a tree, and then staggered back to his room. He scraped the bucket with a gourd for water, but the bucket was empty. He collapsed on his robes. At first light, the terrified Mrs. Grinder sent her children to fetch the servants. When they got to Lewis's room, they found him busily engaged in cutting himself from head to foot with his razor. Lewis saw Pernier and said to him, 'I have done the business, my good servant. Now give me some water.' Pernier did. Lewis uncovered his side and showed them the second wound. He said, 'I am no coward, but I am so strong that it is hard to die.' He said he had tried to kill himself to deprive his enemies of the pleasure and honor of doing it. He begged the servants to take his rifle and blow out his brains, telling them not to be afraid, for he would not hurt them and they could have all of the money in his trunk. Shortly after sunrise, his great heart stopped beating." End quote. Full disclosure, There are some who believe that what I just described never happened, and that Lewis was, in fact, murdered. Here's the thing. There are issues with Mrs. Grinder's account. Even years after the fact, she would change certain aspects of her story. If you're looking for a conspiracy as far as Lewis's death is concerned, and you've got an active enough imagination, then you'll find one. But as for me, I do believe that the evidence strongly suggests that Lewis did, indeed, take his own life. And what's more, the two men that knew Lewis the best, William Clark and Thomas Jefferson, felt the same way. They had both lived with the man for extended periods, were privy to the inner workings of his mind, and although they did express deep remorse, neither one of them ever thought that any kind of foul play was involved. You know, at the end of the day, I don't think anyone can take away from the fact that Meriwether Lewis was a damn good man in a crisis. When Private Windsor fell off that cliff, Lewis knew exactly what to do. When confronted by rapids and a fork in the river, stolen horses, or aggressive Blackfeet, Captain Lewis knew exactly what to do. He was, without a doubt, a man of action, and as Thomas Jefferson described him, a man of courage undaunted. It was ordinary life that Lewis struggled with, the monotony of day-to-day bullshit, coupled with what most historians believed was a chemical imbalance of the brain. A noise in his head that he couldn't turn off once the expedition was over. I think the immense responsibilities and challenges of the expedition were enough to keep the demons in Lewis's head at bay for a time. And then, once they were back home and the quote-unquote struggle was over, when Lewis was no longer engaged with a cause larger than himself, that's when he really began to unravel. That's when those demons started doing jumping jacks. Are there other factors at work? Sure. You know, it's widely believed that at some point, Lewis had contracted malaria. And we do know that in some cases, when left untreated, malaria can result in the swelling of blood vessels in the brain. And that can sometimes result in mental issues. Also, there's all that mercury he was taking, right? The old saying, mad as a hatter, supposedly comes from hat makers who were using mercury in the production of felt. Long-term exposure resulted in neurological disorders that can cause everything from depression to apathy, personality changes, and even delirium. And remember, Lewis and the others were taking high doses of mercury to treat any and all ills during the expedition. But more than anything else, I do think it was just a chemical imbalance in his brain, something he had absolutely no control over. And it's that brain of his, or what was left of it, that eventually did him in there at Grinder's Mill. And I think on that happy note, that's about all I've got on the Lewis and Clark expedition. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, if you'd like to continue learning more about the Corps of Discovery, check out Undaunted Courage by Stephen Ambrose. Don't forget about the Explorers podcast with Matt Breen and Lindsey Graham and the team over there at American History Tellers also have a great series on the expedition. If I'm not mistaken, that series is currently being re-aired right now. And yeah, thanks again. Head on over to WildWestExtra.com for more true tales from the Wild and Woolly West. Make sure you sign up for that newsletter, and I hope to see you next week as we dive into the life of the first mountain man, John Coulter. Till then, adios.